All right, well, welcome everybody to the Gladstone AI Podcast, where we unpack the absolute cutting edge of AI in plain English, and we explain what the latest AI systems mean for procurement, right, for the new capabilities that companies and people might be interested in procuring and building out themselves. And also we talk about the risks that these new capabilities introduce, right? So you have a new AI system, things like, you know, what malicious uses could it introduce? How could people use this maliciously? Also, what new kinds of AI accidents could this introduce? So if you're looking for that global perspective, if you're looking for that kind of strategic perspective on the field, that's really what we're here to deliver, right? So we're going to be talking about these AI systems and really what they mean for the world in practical terms. Now, I wanted to be here today with Ed and Mark. These are two of the co-founders of Gladstone, and along with me, Jeremy. And unfortunately, that just didn't work out. You know, I'm about to head out on my honeymoon, so we kind of had a bit of crunch time. So you're just going to get me for this episode, but I will do my absolute best to make this a good one. And I think a really good place to start with this is actually to tell the story of why this moment in the history of AI is so special. And really, this is going to, in some sense, motivate the entire podcast. Like, why are we tracking cutting-edge AI systems? Why are they relevant to non-technical people today in a way that they simply haven't been at any point in the past? So that's what we're going to be talking about today. I hope you enjoy the episode. Okay, so what makes this moment in the history of AI so special, right? Why are we now at a stage where non-technical people have no choice? You know, whether you're working in procurement at a big company, whether you're in a startup looking to understand the space, whether you're in defense or national security trying to understand the risks and opportunities that come with this technology, why can you not afford to ignore this space today? So the answer to this question actually has to do with a major breakthrough in AI that happened in 2020. So in 2020, roughly speaking, researchers kind of cracked the code on making far more human-like, far more powerful AI systems than had ever been possible before. There was this one major research breakthrough. It came out of a California lab called OpenAI, and they figured out basically that all the work that world-leading AI labs had been doing up to that point. So they were building these AI systems that were modeled based on the structure of the human brain, right? So they were called like neural networks. And the reason they're called neural networks is that they had these things called artificial neurons inside them that were explicitly based on the structure and function of the neurons in the human brain, right? So your brain has neurons. These are like the thinking cells, the cells that do all the thinking for you. And AI systems, modern AI systems, most of them use these kinds of artificial neurons that are trying to essentially imitate the same activity in computers. And so for a long time, the way that people made progress in AI was they came up with clever ways of hooking up their neurons together, wiring them together in increasingly fancy ways. And essentially what happened in 2020 was this California lab called OpenAI said, hey, wait a minute. You know, maybe the thing that's holding back AI progress now, maybe it's not that we haven't come up with a clever enough way of wiring together all of these neurons. You know, maybe we don't need to bother with that so much. Maybe instead, the thing we should focus on is making bigger artificial brains, basically cramming together way more of these neurons. Maybe the number of neurons, in some sense, kind of matters more than everything else. Like it doesn't matter how fancy you get with your neuron connections and all that stuff. Maybe the thing that fundamentally matters most is how many neurons you've got in your system. And so OpenAI builds this really big, you can think of it as like a big artificial brain, this thing with a ton of these artificial neurons. And, you know, this brain, I mean, like, it's a lot of neurons. It's a lot of things that have to be set correctly. Like, it's a lot of, a lot of precision that has to be applied to make the system work just right because of how many moving parts there are in it. And so it also costs a lot of processing power, a lot of compute power. They've got to buy really expensive or buy access to really expensive processors to do this. And the system they built cost $10 million to build. But what they ended up with was this AI called GPT-3. Now, GPT-3 was really just a text autocomplete system. So you would give it a sentence or a couple of words, and, you know, just like the autocomplete on your phone, it would guess what the most likely next word would be that you might want to write. And how was it trained to do this? Well, basically, it read most of the text on the internet. You can kind of think of it that way. And as it would read, it would try to predict the next word that would come. And then based on the word that actually showed up on the page, it would tweak its neurons a little bit every time until after it read billions and billions of words, it got really, really good at performing that task, at being this text autocomplete AI. But the thing is, although it was only trained to do text autocomplete, GPT-3 turned out to be capable of doing a lot more stuff. In fact, it could write human-like essays that were so human-like that humans couldn't tell those essays apart from something that would have been written by a real flesh and blood human being. It could answer questions. It could write code. It could translate between languages. All sorts of things that nobody saw coming. And all thanks to its massive size. This was a huge breakthrough, and no one was more surprised than OpenAI, the lab that actually, again, built GPT-3 in the first place. Nobody expected it to be able to do all of those things, but it really marked the beginning of a revolution in AI, where all of a sudden, people knew, oh wow, you know, if we just scale these systems up, if we make them these really big artificial brains, we cram all of these artificial neurons into this structure and we train it, we develop it, we build it using a huge amount of processing power, we will end up with systems with downright human-like capabilities across a wide range of tasks. And so that's sort of the new era of AI that GPT-3 gave us. It gave us this recipe, right? This strategy we could follow to just build more and more capable systems. Okay, so people start to notice this, and as a result, they jump into what's since been referred to as the AI scaling race. So basically, companies from China, Israel, South Korea, Russia, and so on, they all start pouring money into building their own versions of GPT-3. And this starts to happen about a year after GPT-3 came out. So GPT-3 comes out, everybody freaks out. They try to figure out, you know, how can we build our own version of this system? This really seems like it's going to be the future. And then you start to see these replications in all these different countries, at all these different companies, and very quickly the stuff proliferates. So that's actually in a way exciting, right? Because the kind of industry capabilities that this implies are kind of crazy. We have here an AI system that can write code. And actually, since then, what you can think of as like more advanced versions of GPT-3, they've since been able to code so well that they can, in some cases, outcompete human competitive programmers. Like they are that good. That's the state of AI-powered code generation today, all thanks to this idea of scaling these systems up, making them bigger, using a lot of processing power, using a lot of these artificial neurons and a lot of data. And so that's just code generation. But of course, now, you know, these systems are giving us better language translation capabilities. You can make actual customer service chatbots that don't suck. So these systems can actually have an interaction, a very credible, plausible, human-like interaction with someone. And we're seeing companies like MessageBird actually use exactly these systems now to power a whole new generation of very plausible-seeming customer service chatbots. We're seeing all kinds of new applications. And like the list is almost endless. And you can actually look up, like if you Google like GPT-3 applications or GPT-3 startups, you will see dozens and dozens and dozens of startups, many of which have raised millions or tens of millions of dollars just building on top of GPT-3. All they are is like this thin layer on top of GPT-3 that customizes it a little bit for downstream applications. But it's all powered by this one massive AI system. That's the big breakthrough here, right? We have massive centralization now. A single AI that can perform a wide range of tasks, all of a sudden it makes sense for people to pour money into building their own versions of it because they know it can support a ridiculous number of downstream applications. Now, one question you know you might have about this system is like, okay, well, how does GPT-3 really do this? Like, how do you go from a text autocomplete system to a system that can write code? Like that seems like a bit of a stretch. And one way to think about it is, you know, you have a sentence like Jack and Jill went up the blank. Right? Imagine you feed that to a text autocomplete system. In order to fill in that blank, your text autocomplete system is going to have to learn an awful lot about the world. Right? It's going to have to learn what a hill is, that Jack and Jill refer to different names, what it means to go up a hill, and so on and so forth. It's also going to have to know sayings, right? Like, it's going to have to recognize, oh, Jack and Jill went up the hill. That's a thing that people say. Likewise, if you get the system to complete a sentence like, in order to counter a rising China, the United States should blank, right? To fill in that blank, your AI system needs to know what the United States is, what China is. You know, it needs to know all about like kind of geopolitical competition, that sort of stuff. It needs to know an awful lot about the world. And that's exactly the kind of broad knowledge about logic, math, science, geopolitics, and so on that GPT-3 picked up by being trained to do autocomplete on basically all the text on the internet. That's how it picks up this wealth of knowledge. And then you go to your AI system that's been trained in this way, and you say, okay, I'm going to write something like this. Below is a piece of code that checks the weather in my area and prints the temperature on a screen. Right? So if you then write a colon, so below is a piece of code that checks the weather in my area and writes the temperature on a screen, colon, and then you have your autocomplete system suggest the next word. Well, if it's been trained properly, if it's been trained on enough blog posts, for example, that have lines like that, that introduce little chunks of code in them, and there are a ton of those, then it will actually know that the next thing it should write is actually the code that you've just asked it to write. So that's how text autocomplete systems can actually end up doing a whole range of completely unrelated tasks, even though they were never explicitly trained to do them. That's the magic of GPT-3, right? We have this system, this autocomplete system. It's absolutely massive. It's able to hold a whole bunch of knowledge about the world inside of it. And it's been trained on basically all the text on the internet. As a result, it's learned, for example, that if I write something like, the following is the French translation of the sentence, hello, how are you, colon, it knows that the next thing it should expect to follow that is exactly the French translation of hi, how are you, or whatever. Right? So it's essentially learned these patterns in human writing, and it's just a pattern replication machine, but the patterns it's learned are so sophisticated that it actually can match human performance in a wide range of different tasks. That's what's so revolutionary here, right? That's what's behind the AI scaling revolution. So GPT-3 happens, and we get this wide range of different companies that emerge. They just adapt it slightly, right? They give it a slightly different prompt. If you wanted to launch a new translation app, right, you might just write something like, the following is the, you know, French or Japanese translation or whatever of, and then you can have a blank that, I don't know, the user comes in and fills in. And then you send that to GPT-3, and then out comes a translation, and boom, you've made an entirely new app, a language translation app that previously would have taken, you know, weeks or months to build, if it had even been possible at all, right? This is the incredible thing about this system. You know, you do not need to know how to code to effectively be able to give it instructions. You just need to be able to prompt it. You just need to be able to write some text that hints strong enough at the system that the thing that you want is the thing that should come next. So that's part of the revolutionary story here behind GPT-3 is that, you know, for the first time, non-technical people can now interact with these systems, can now give them instructions, in a sense, can now program them, right? As long as you can express a thought in plain English, as long as you can frame it as a prompt for this like autocomplete system, you can get that autocomplete system to perform entirely new tasks at your specifications. And the wild thing about this, in a way, is that it all comes from this very simple idea of AI scaling, right? Just cram together a ton of artificial neurons. Just train them using a huge amount of processing power with a huge amount of data. Dial up those three things, right? The number of the, basically the size of your AI, right? The number of these neurons in a sense, dial up the amount of processing power that they use, dial up the amount of data they use in some magic ratio, and you're just going to get more capabilities out. That really was the breakthrough behind GPT-3. It wasn't so much just the system, GPT-3. It was a powerful system, super impressive for all the reasons we've seen, but just as much as anything, it was the recipe behind it. The fact that for the first time, it kind of gave us this knob that we could tune to just increase the intelligence, increase the capabilities of our AI systems in a reliable way. If you can just throw, you know, an extra $1 million at, you know, adding more processing power, more data, more scaling to your system, you will get a reliable increase in capabilities out. That's what sparked the scaling race in AI. That's the reason that GPT-3 was so geopolitically relevant. Now, everyone kind of knows the recipe to build more intelligent AI systems, and they just have to invest money in racing towards that. So that's sort of how the landscape fundamentally shifted. But now take a second to think about what it means to not know this, what it means to fall behind, what it means to miss out on a system like GPT-3, right? You have this one system that, again, single-handedly is the backbone for dozens of different startups. It's literally transforming an entire industry as we speak today. It sparked trends that are even more fundamental and even more transformational, whose effects we're only starting to feel today, but that are really going to define the future of technology, more than just the future of AI. Missing out on this one system means missing out on all of that. Means having a completely warped perception of the art of the possible in AI. Means not understanding why it is that all of a sudden, basically every major company in the world is trying to throw money at scaling their AI systems. Why it is that the resources behind AI scaling, the inputs to scale AI, are now one of the most valuable commodities in technology, period, full stop. So you'd miss out on geopolitical implications. You'd miss out on procurement. You'd miss out on huge opportunities to operationalize this system in a whole bunch of different ways. But you'd miss out on something else too. You'd miss out on understanding some important risks. So I want to talk about these risks now because they are going to be a recurring theme on the podcast as we talk about some of the latest AI models that have come out in the last, you know, few weeks or whatever. We will be talking about the procurement side. That's sort of a story that we've alluded to here with GPT-3, all the different applications that you can use these new systems for. But we will also be talking about malicious uses and AI accidents. And I want to take a second to kind of explain why those things are relevant in this new era in light of what we just talked about with GPT-3 here. So imagine, you know, you live in the year 2019. There's no GPT-3 yet. What are some of the things that AI can't do? Well, for one, AI cannot massively augment a foreign influence operation. So if you think back to 2016, right, the Russians interfered in the US presidential election, how'd they do it? They hired 400 contractors. They got them to work around the clock to write by hand a whole bunch of posts on Western social media. They reached about 126 million people on Facebook alone, and by many measures, it was an extremely successful operation, but it was costly. Right? They had to hire 400 people. That's millions of dollars. Each of those 400 contractors was a potential source of leaks. Each of them gets tired, sick, thirsty, hungry, and so on. And so if you could, you'd love to automate a lot of their work away. By the way, these people also have to be native English speakers. Right? They have to be aware of kind of American culture and so on if they're going to pull off this interference operation successfully. That's a whole bunch of recruitment requirements in a very challenging domain. And so you would love to be able to automate this work. You'd love to be able to do that. Overnight, GPT-3 makes that possible. Right? You now have a potential source of human-like AI-generated content. You can give it a quick, simple prompt. You can get clever and give it a prompt that is based on a text exchange and then just have it automatically respond to that text exchange, just like an organic flesh and blood user would on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, with a very context-aware, sort of relevant response. That is all entirely possible now today. In fact, it's Very likely this has already been used. We have reports of China having used a system very much like this to generate disinformation in the context of the Taiwan 2020 national election. And so this is far from hypothetical. Now that's one malicious application of GPT-3. But as you might imagine, you know, having an AI system that can generate human-like text opens up a Pandora's box of malicious applications. We're not going to talk about them all today because this particular episode of the podcast isn't about being exhaustive with GPT-3. It's just about motivating kind of what this new era is all about and this idea that a new AI system can unleash this like cluster of risks. But I do want to give another example or two here. So let's say that we want to pull off a phishing attack, right? So what's a phishing attack? Well, it's when you send an email to somebody and maybe you have an attachment in that email with some malware. You want that person to download the attachment and install your malware on their computer, right? That's a phishing attack. Now, historically, if you wanted to pull off a phishing attack, you'd have to make a very difficult choice. Do I pick a small number of high-value targets and I look up their LinkedIn profiles and I look up their Facebook profiles and kind of get a good read on who they are and what their life's all about? And, you know, write a small number of super highly tailored, highly customized emails. That's one strategy. Or instead, maybe I decide to write one generic email and send it out to 100,000 people. And then I just cross my fingers and I hope that like 0.1% of those people actually get fooled by it, download that file, and so on. And this trade-off between customizability and scale is something that's been treated as like a fundamental trade-off in phishing. Cyber defenders have relied on it, depended on it, for the last three decades implicitly. Organizations had their entire cybersecurity operations, policies, all kinds of stuff that depends implicitly on this assumption. Overnight, when GPT-3 came out, it violated that assumption. GPT-3 can now write better phishing emails than humans. It can also be used to write 100,000 customized emails to 100,000 recipients all at once, completely violating this trade-off. You could get GPT-3 to, you know, tailor the emails that it sends based on the social media profiles of the people you're sending those emails to, based on their job descriptions, based on their past experience, whatever. This is all fully within the realm of the possible today now. Again, all because of one system. Right? So if you miss out on GPT-3, yes, you're missing out on this huge procurement opportunity, this huge opportunity to even come up with new company ideas, new product lines, improve back office processes, all that great stuff. You can use GPT-3 to summarize documents, translate languages, all that stuff. That is good stuff. But you're also missing out on an awareness of a whole cluster of malicious applications of this tool that we're all now exposed to. Without having that awareness, without tracking the story, you're basically flying blind through one of the greatest tests of technology security that we've ever encountered with this new generation of AI tools. So the story of sort of AI malicious use is now starting to unfold in a very real way. You know, we actually, as a little example, if you want to go to a little fun kind of website, thispersondoesnotexist.com is just a micro example of the kinds of things that are possible today. You go to thispersondoesnotexist.com and you will see a new face, an AI-generated face of a person who, well, doesn't exist. And Russian interference operations have relied on this to actually create profile pictures for Twitter profiles in particular that then look human-like. You know, you can't Google reverse image search these images to find, oh, you know, it's actually a stock photo from whatever. It just looks authentic. And so you marry that with a system like GPT-3 that can generate very plausible human-like text, and all of a sudden you have the stuff of a social media bot army, the likes of which we've never seen before. Individual bots that look completely human-like. You know, another thing to think about too, when we talk about social media bots, imagine like the last, I don't know if you spend much time on the Twitters, but if you do, you know, you go to Twitter and you might run into one of these bot accounts that like is really obviously a bot account. Like, how do you know? Well, they're constantly talking about whatever topic, you know, maybe they're shilling Bitcoin or they're shilling some cryptocurrency or whatever scheme. And it's just this like very repetitive series of consistent posts all on the same topic. So why does that happen? Well, it happens because if you're a, you know, bot or actually a troll, you know, if you have a you know, 400 contractors, say, pumping out a bunch of content for a scam, a bunch of Facebook or social media posts for a scam, you know, each of those contractors has to actually write every post. And they can't afford to waste time writing posts that are off topic, posts that don't address the topic that they're trying to advance, the issue they're trying to advance. And so it doesn't make sense for a Bitcoin bot or a Bitcoin troll to post about anything other than Bitcoin, or a crypto troll, more appropriately, to post about anything other than the specific crypto that they're interested in shilling. Because if they were to post about the weather, that's just wasted time, right? That's wasted contractor time. That's expensive stuff. Now, GPT-3 makes the cost of content generation like that go basically to zero, which means you can now imagine making an army of fully human-like social media bots who have posting histories that include stuff that's totally irrelevant to the issue that they're actually designed to promote or put forward. So you make a bunch of bots that are designed to, I don't know, try to suppress the Muslim vote or something. And they're not just posting nonstop about how Muslim people shouldn't vote. No, every once in a while, they're posting about sports, the weather, whatever, because those posts are made by GPT-3. They don't cost any money to write. They don't cost contractor time. So all of a sudden, you can afford to make your bots infinitely more human-like. Impossible functionally to distinguish from a real human account. So anyway, this whole scope, this whole range of different possibilities, you know, this includes things like you could have corporate sentiment manipulation too. Companies could get into this game in theory and start using this to attack each other's products, undermine each other's marketing campaigns. There's all kinds of applications that come from this one AI system that we're now all exposed to. And as AI has gotten better, as AI systems have gotten more scaled, as the scaling race has taken off, things are only getting worse. And so understanding the malicious uses of AI is absolutely critical to really every organization's risk understanding, their kind of operational, their situational awareness of the risk landscape that they face, but also to the strategic decisions that they make. Which strategic risks are you willing to expose yourself to, knowing that AI can do the things that it can currently do? That's why we're tracking malicious uses of AI on this podcast going forward. Now, finally, I want to talk about AI accidents too. See, because as AI systems become more and more clever, as they become more and more powerful and capable, the mistakes that they make become more and more important, more and more risky and dangerous, actually, in many cases. So GPT-3 gives us an early glimpse into the future of AI accidents. And so in this somewhat unusual episode of the podcast, I do want to take the liberty to talk about both how AI accidents look in GPT-3 and what that kind of landscape looks like, but also what the future of AI accidents might look like with systems that increasingly are becoming much, much more powerful than GPT-3, as we've seen in the last few months and years. So let's start with GPT-3 and the AI accident story there, right? So GPT-3, again, is a text autocomplete system. That's what it was designed to do. Right, you give it a few words, and then it predicts the most likely next words that would follow based on its reading of all the internet. So one way to think about how GPT-3 works is that you give it a prompt of some kind, and then GPT-3 figures out, you know, if I was looking at this prompt on the internet, if I saw this on some random page on the internet, what would I expect would come next? So one way this can fail is if you give it a prompt like, who really caused 9/11? Right, you ask GPT-3, who really caused 9/11? Question mark. And then you start a sentence like, 9/11 was caused by, and then you have it fill that in. Well, what you actually find in practice is that quite often GPT-3 will complete that sentence, that prompt, by saying that the US government caused 9/11. Now, why is that? Well, because the original question that you prompted it with wasn't who caused 9/11. It was who really caused 9/11. And so if you came across that sentence on the internet in some random page and you saw, oh, who really caused 9/11? Question mark. You might actually expect, rightly, that the next few words would actually be sort of laden with conspiracy theory kind of intimations, because that's what the word really is doing there. It's a bit of a hint that whoever is writing this, they have a certain slant that they want to put forward in their question. It's a sort of biasing question. So you see this all the time with these systems. You know, you see a subtle difference to the, a subtle change made to the prompt that causes a big change in the response. These systems don't always generate correct or truthful responses because they're not trying to be truthful, right? They're trying to predict the next word that might come in a sequence of words. They're trying to do autocomplete. And when you, you know, expect them to be helpful, well, that's, they're only going to be as helpful as, you know, the autocomplete task that they're programmed to do allows them to be. So there's a difference between the thing that we're training these systems to do, which is text autocomplete, and the thing we want them to do, which is just be helpful and truthful. And this is actually a really deep problem with AI today. Every AI system anyone has ever been able to build has been trained by kind of getting it to improve a proxy, getting it to optimize for a proxy metric, basically. So, you know, we want an AI system to be a helpful text generator. Well, we train it to do autocomplete because we don't really know how to train it to be helpful. Right? Helpfulness is just not like something that we know how to turn into a number that we can get our AI system to learn from or learn to improve. And so, anyway, that's a problem at the heart of these systems, is that the thing we ask them to do is quite often different from the thing that we want them to do. And it's very easy to forget that. And then you can end up with what's known as an alignment failure, basically a failure to align your intent, what you want out of the system, with the thing that you're asking the system to do. And for various reasons, people actually worry about this kind of failure leading to a source of global catastrophic risk in the long term as AIs become increasingly clever and creative. One way to think about that is, you know, you think about it like a self-driving car, right? You ask it to, I don't know, get you from point A to point B as fast as possible. That's like the thing that you train it to do. And, you know, you might find the self-driving car goes, oh, okay, you know, I guess I'll drive through this building then. That's the fastest way to do that. And you kind of go, whoa, no, like, let's not do that. Let's add a new rule and say, no driving through buildings, right? And then your self-driving car goes, okay, no problem. I'll just go the wrong way down this one-way street over here. And you go, whoa, no, not like that. Let's add a new rule. No going the wrong way down a one-way street. And the self-driving car goes, okay, then I guess I'll just run over this mother with her stroller. And you go, no, not like that. And so you kind of find yourself playing this game of whack-a-mole where every time you think you've covered all your bases, the AI comes up with some new kind of dangerously creative solution that accomplishes the objective you told it to accomplish, which is get me from point A to point B as fast as possible in this case, but with a whole range of different side effects, some of which could be absolutely devastating. So there's actually been a lot of policy interest in this question. There's a whole bunch of legislation, some actually in the US. So the Global Catastrophic Risk Mitigation Act explicitly calls out catastrophic risk from AI systems as a result of these kinds of accidents. And the UK's Ministry of Defense put out their defense AI strategy, which also calls out, I think they refer to existential risk actually from more advanced forms of this kind of failure. And you know, when you look at people at the cutting edge of AI today, in the AI safety world, in the AI alignment world, this is what they worry about. Kind of, will AI systems come up with dangerously creative solutions to achieve their programmed objectives that nonetheless have extreme consequences, extremely negative side effects for the rest of humanity? And right now, research really seems to indicate that that is the default outcome that we should expect. So there's research that's been done, some of it's been published in the top research conferences in AI in the world. And really increasingly, like, all the evidence seems to be stacking up in that direction. There's basically no empirical evidence that has us, you know, pointing in the other direction saying, oh no, these things will be fine. For some magical reason, AI systems that already today are coming up with these dangerously creative solutions that we don't want, that have all these dangerous side effects, that behavior will not persist for some reason above a certain threshold of intelligence. There is no evidence for that, but there is an increasing body of evidence saying, hey, we should actually expect this stuff to become more of an issue and not less as AI systems get more clever, as they're able to come up with more dangerously creative solutions to their programmed objectives. So all of this is to say, there's a big landscape of risk from malicious use, risk from AI accidents, all of which needs to be tracked very closely. There is opportunity that comes with this technology as well. That's crucial to track too, right? The proliferation story, right? What can these systems do for me today? As progress in AI continues to accelerate at the absolute like mind-blowing rates that it's accelerating at today, where you know, you're out of date if you stop tracking this stuff from, sometimes it feels like from 1 week to the next, but certainly it's from 1 month to the next, you can end up getting outcompeted by someone who's actually keeping up with this stuff, right? Who's actually fielding the latest and greatest, who's actually able to automate away the work of, I don't know, entire sales teams at this point, when you have GPT-3 that can, you know, have customer interactions that are really true to human-like human-like dialogue. So this sort of thing is really important to track, the opportunities and the risks. And that fundamentally is what we're all about on this podcast. So I'll be joined by my co-founders, Ed and Mark. Maybe Ed more often just because he's doing more of our AI tracking work. So he's the brain behind AItracker.org, Gladstone AI's sort of like free AI tracking tier. And we'll be talking about the models that appear on that catalog. Every week, we put out whatever the latest AI models are, AI systems with new capabilities that we think are relevant to procurement, malicious use, or AI accident risks. And they're there translated into plain English for you. We'll be doing a lot of that translation on this podcast as well, explaining what they are, why they matter, and why you should be paying attention to them and the future of AI. So hope this was useful. And if so, please do, do the old thing, like, comment, subscribe, follow us wherever you listen to your podcasts. And we'll look forward to seeing you on the next one, which, by the way, normally we'd be doing this every week. But I am heading out, as I mentioned, on my honeymoon, actually in about 24 hours. And that's going to take us to, I think, the beginning of November. So that'll be beginning of November 2022 is when we'll be back with episode 2 of the Gladstone AI podcast. Thanks so much for listening.